Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 30th, 2018. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, home mead maker Tim Lieber shares an experiment testing whether pasteurizing mead in the bottle works. And if it does, what effect the process has on the character of the mead. He'll also share a tasty bonus mead, too. Go to basicbrewing.com. You can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, they say that'll help new listeners to find us. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. If you haven't seen the latest Basic Brewing video episode, it's out there now. It's the video featuring the hoppy amber ale that my son Drew and I brewed together. It turned out very well, both the beer and the experience of working together to brew it. And it's almost gone from the keg, by the way. But no worries, I've brewed another beer to take its place. It's my take on a brute pale ale. I used an enzyme from White Labs to make the wort more fermentable, and the Imperial A30 corporate really liked that wort. In fact, the day after I pitched, the foam in the carboy was rising closer to the opening of the carboy, slowly but surely. And so I made a mental note to drop a couple of drops of Firm Cap S in there to avoid a brewing disaster. But, of course, I forgot that mental note until about 5 o'clock in the morning. The next morning, I woke up and I said, oh, yeah, I was going to do that. So I went downstairs into the little bathroom where the beer was, and I discovered that the airlock was clogged with stuff. It wasn't bubbling. So I gently dislodged the stopper, and what little hair I have was blown back as a big poof erupted from the carboy. And then the foam started rising. I was, however, able to get the carboy into the bathtub before it ran over too much. It continued to run all over the place until I applied a couple of drops of Firm Cap S to calm it down. And that seemed to work, so I put a patch of aluminum foil over the opening until later on in the day when I replaced the cleaned and sanitized stopper and airlock. And the good thing about putting your carboy in the shower or in the bathtub is that if you got one of those showers with, you know, that's on a wand, that's on a big hose, you can just spray off the outside of the carboy and clean things up easier that way. Surprisingly, there is still a big head of foam on top of the beer, so the Firm Cap S, you know, didn't get rid of all of it, and I think that's probably a good thing. I'm going to cold crash the beer after it completely finishes primary fermentation, and then dry hop in the keg. More details about that beer later. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Mark from Bellevue, Washington, writes after hearing another letter a couple weeks back about using homegrown fresh hops. Mark says, inspired by both your Harvest Ale video cast and various hop podcasts, I started growing hops in the front yard 3 seasons ago and now have Northern Brewer, ESG, that's East Seattle Goldings, and Tettnanger in various stages of harvest. Labor Day's coming up. Mark says, for me, that means it's about time to harvest my hops and brew a Labor Day fresh hop ale. So a couple of my Homer Simpson dough learnings, Mark says. First, decide your approach. Some folks use commercial hops for calculating bittering or calculable, a little Tom Brokaw there, calculable bittering and homegrown for a personal touch. And Mark is in the school of, if you're going to grow your own hops, might as well load up at least one batch with only your own fresh hops picked wet on the vine and into the wort 5 minutes later. Can't predict the bitterness, but I think that's part of the obsession. Second, Mark says, boil in a lot of fresh hops. 1 pound is not necessarily a lot for a 5-gallon batch. Whew! Mark says, number 3, you can dry out some of the fresh hops for later for dry hopping, or you can just wet hop the cooled wort. Your mileage may vary. Number 4, taste the wort during boil after it's cooled, fully pitched. If there's not enough hop bitterness, then make a hop tea to add to the fermenter. Mark says, for some reason last year I threw in the harvested hops, but didn't taste test until bottling time, only to discover I basically had unpalatable sweet malt drink. The hops didn't mature or do their business. Either way, it was a pour out. It's a shame. And finally, Mark says yeast should be a personal preference. Clean and neutral will give your hops the most chance to shine. I'm sure you and listeners have more tips and tricks for a fresh hop batch, and now it's a good time to get feedback. Thanks for the thoughts, Mark. Boy, a pound of whole hops in I'm assuming 5 gallons of beer. Was there any wort left? I like to call hop cones little wort sponges, because they tend to soak up the wort. Of course, again, it's all up to personal preference. I hope everybody's having good hop harvests out there if you're harvesting your own hops. Let's talk about our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. High Gravity now sells the product of another one of our sponsors, Imperial Organic Yeast. You know we love Imperial, and it's great to know High Gravity has added them to the product mix. Also, you'll hear Tim Lieber talk about using a sous vide approach later in the show to pasteurize bottled meads. A high-gravity electric brewing system with a Warthog controller is an excellent sous vide tool. It's great when you can use brewing gear for other purposes and normal stuff for brewing purposes. On the Basic Brewing video, you've seen Steve use his high-gravity system to sous vide steaks and infuse meads into fruit. He's also used it to sous vide barbecue ribs. And high-gravity coincidentally, high-gravity electric systems also make great beer. In addition to cooking meat and stuff, it turns out they make great beer. The Warthog controllers have mash and boil modes that make hitting and maintaining mash temperatures and getting your boil levels the way you like them makes it extremely easy. And High Gravity sells brew in a bag, 2 and 3 vessel systems from 5 gallons all the way up to 2 barrels. So there's something for everyone. Check out the great selection of electric brewing systems and now Imperial Yeast at highgravitybrew.com. And if you use the promo code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric brewing gear purchase. Brewing season is upon us. Take it to the next level at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. Okay, sadly, this is the last episode we recorded in Portland in connection with HomebrewCon. I'm always happy to get together with this group of guys. We have fun together and learn stuff, too. Let's go back to a Portland hotel room to talk to Tim Lieber about his experiment in pasteurizing mead in the bottle. Well, Tim Lieber, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And here we have Steve Wilkes.
Hey, James, and everyone else in the room.
And Norm Kwasinski.
Hey, how are you all doing?
And Bob Stimsky.
Hi, James.
We have a pair of skis here. If we had a boat, we could go out on the lake. I thought that joke would go a little better. And then Zod O'Connor.
Howdy, everybody.
So we have everybody here has been on the show before. So we tend to all meet in shady hotel rooms with bottles of intoxicants. So there's nothing abnormal about that whatsoever.
Not according to my parole officer, no.
So we're here to talk about mead, Tim. What are we doing?
So this is another experiment I've done trying to test some of the conventional wisdom about mead making, some of which I advocate for. So the thing about this result is it was very clear that people could tell the difference between the two, but nobody could tell what I had done. So it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out here, whether or not anybody can figure out what I did. But it was very clear. I ran this through my homebrew club and through a couple other people. So about my testing pool is about 50. And I didn't bother to do a triangle test, and I didn't bother to do you know, some of the correlations that some of the brewlosophy guys do, because it was, like I said, it was very clear, but I was not looking for can you tell the difference. I was looking for can you tell what I did.
So what we're going to do is we've each got a couple of plastic cups, and you're going to pour us two samples, and we're going to do a little sensory thing, and then we'll come back and maybe pick everybody's brain as to what they think's what.
Yeah, we'll do that, and then I'll explain exactly what I did and why I think this is actually significant for a lot of mead makers out there.
Awesome. It's very exciting. All right. Well, we're going to pause, and then we're going to drink and taste, and we'll be right back. Okay, we've had a chance to taste. It's a fairly, I would say, a fairly simple mead. It doesn't seem to be fruited or anything. I would say maybe it's a fairly low gravity mead.
It's a ginger hydromel because, you know, you guys in Groenfeld hit me for making you drunk every time. So,
so
just the mead.
So there is a drastic difference between the two. Should I go first since I'm already talking? The first one is not as interesting as the second one, in my opinion. The second one to me is more kind of bright and maybe acidic, and maybe to my palate maybe a little sort of tart. I don't know if that's the proper descriptor, but it really jumps out. It's like, wow, there's a lot of flavor there. Norm?
Well, the second one, which you were saying had more flavor, there's a little slight carbonation to it, which I was wondering if that carbonic acid kind of like brighten up that flavor. But yeah.
So. Yeah, it's a little, it's just ever so slightly spritzy, and it is brighter, and I'm with you. I don't know whether that's because of the little bit of carbonation or not, and it does have a more flavor. The first one actually tastes pretty nice, but it's kind of like there's just nothing there very much. They're both well made. There's nothing, there's no flaws in them at all. So that's always a plus. And I like the second one better. What have you done differently? I don't have a clue. If I was going to guess at this moment, maybe I don't want to guess right now.
Oh, okay. We'll get the sensory inputs.
Well, that first one was just kind of wimpy, flat, tasteless, and it was just like flavored water to me.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Sorry, I got to be honest. The second one was, like you said, bright, sharp. It had taste, and I think it was like the second one was the first run, and this one was the second run using the same, I don't know. It's just that much difference. It's bad.
So the first one definitely had a grape smell to it, which would be a yeast characteristic like a Chardonnay. For those who are at home, it's a very clear mead, just a very light straw flavor to it. And it had a really nice yeast nose, but not much flavor. The second one didn't have as much nose at all, but had a lot of flavor and definitely got that spritzy feel coming in. Now, this is my third time tasting this ginger hydromel, because I just tasted it in a course Tim ran a mead test yesterday, and I would score the second one higher than what I scored the one yesterday, which was overwhelming with the ginger. And I didn't even really get ginger, to be honest, until you said it, because I couldn't figure it out. And then, bam, it hit me in the head, like, oh, that's light ginger. Very nice, very, you know, just gentle ginger, which is what I wanted on it yesterday. So I really like the second one. I would guess it's somehow you're getting more spritz if it's purposely carbonated, but it also feels thicker. It felt colder in my tongue, yet it was the same temperature in the glass, which was, I kept checking that because I think it just tastes, there's more muchness in it, to quote Alice in Wonderland, where the first one after the nose, it was a hydromel. There wasn't much there, which is actually nice and gentle, and you don't get James drunk, you know, on your first experiment. But so I would, if I had to guess, I would actually guess it's either carbonated or when the ginger is added, maybe causing some carbonation.
Yeah, the first one, I wouldn't say that it's bad. It's just not very interesting, you know, especially compared to the second one. It's so bright.
It's not fair to have the two of them side by side, really. because they are different products in how they taste and drink. So if you'd had the first one by itself, you'd be, oh, that was nice. Mm-hmm. But when you have the first one and then the second one, you think, oh, the second one's nice, and the first one kind of sucks. I can say that. It's my mead.
And as they've warmed up, I just took another sip. The ginger is much more evident in the second one. Much, much more evident now.
Any other impressions before we get the secrets?
The second one is ever so slightly lighter in color, which is, I don't know if that has any real flavor, but it just happens to be.
So, are we on the right track?
You're on the right track, but you haven't given your impressions yet, have you?
Yeah, I said the first one was kind of blah, and the second one was like bright and a little more acidic, a little more tart. And
all right, now that everybody's laid their cards on the table, I'll tell you what it is. This is a ginger hydromel I made. When it was done, I added a little Cascade Candy ginger syrup to it, and I took half and bottled it, and half I bottled and put it in a sous vide at 165 degrees for 5 minutes. So I pasteurized. Number one. Number two, the sparkly one was not pasteurized, so it carbonated to petalant. So, like I said, it's easy to tell that this one's different than that one. But the difference is, and Norm came closer to it than anybody else has when he talked about the color, the second one was cooked, like I said, at 160 degrees for 5 minutes. Now that's put it in a water bath, bring it up to 160 degrees, and then hold it for 5 minutes. You know, so it pasteurized out. So they're exactly the same back sweetening. But that little bit of carbonation makes a huge difference in how it presents itself. But that is the difference, is one's been cooked. And nobody, like I said, I had like 50 people in the panel. Nobody's picked up any cooked flavors, you know, cooked honey, any of that stuff. And, of course, the assumption is, I've heard all the years, and I kind of did this with a boil experiment, is don't cook honey, it'll give you a cooked honey flavor. Don't heat it up because you'll lose alcohol and everything. Now, if you're playing the home game, 165 degrees at 5 minutes is a USDA recommendation. I'd go out and do that. I basically modeled my process off of what America's Test Kitchen recommends for doing pickles. Low temperature pasteurized pickles. However, you also go out there, they'll say like 180 degrees for like 1 minute. I bottled some, put it in 180 degrees, and two of them shot crown caps off the top. So if you're playing the home game, do not do that. 165 degrees for 5 minutes after it gets to 165 degrees is plenty. Now, what I did to make sure of that was, I have my thing set, but I had a bottle full of water that was the same volume that I had in the middle of my bottles that I was pasteurizing, that I had a thermometer in, and I went by that. So I figured by the time, because they all were at the same temperature, so I figured by the time that bottle of water came up to 165 degrees, the bottles of mead would have as well.
Tell us which one was cooked and which one wasn't?
The one that everybody talked about having a little bit of sparkle, the one everybody liked better, was not cooked. Okay. Right. It was the first one was cooked because it is dead flat.
Right.
You know, and they're the exact same mead otherwise. But that little bit of carbonation came in, you know, and it just lifts the whole thing.
Yeah.
It brings up the aroma, it brings up a little acidity, it's not so flabby, and it just makes it better. And it's only about a 5% mead. You know, so I think there's nowhere to hide, you know, if it's kind of fallen flat. And that little bit of sparkle helps a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people, if you want to get an impression, and I've said this before on the show, but if you want to get an impression of what flavor contribution carbonation gives to a beverage, you take a Coke freshly open and you taste it, and it burns. It burns the back of your throat. You take a Coke and shake out the carbonation so it's flat, and it's just sweet and syrupy, and it's a completely different beverage. So,
two things. I just looked it up, and the boiling temperature of alcohol, ethanol, is 171.
Yes.
So going to 180, guaranteed problem. And beer judging, we actually do that just with two of the exact same bottles of bottled water of spritz. So there's nothing else in there but minerals and CO2, and probably not a lot of minerals, and it's radically different.
What do you think, Bob?
I think everybody's right.
I was just in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So I mean, do we the feedback that we the sensory feedback that we gave you, is it similar to what everybody else said?
You're right in line with everybody. Everybody knows instantly that these two are different, and everybody thinks that the one that is carbonated, the second one I gave you, is more lively, more interesting, a better mead. But nobody picked out cooked flavors. You know, I put in ginger because ginger flavor of ginger changes as it cooks pretty readily, pretty apparently. Mm-hmm. And so nobody picked that out. Norm said something about the color. Well, the color would be driven by, you know, a slight caramelization, but we picked that up in the boil experiment, if everybody remembers. But again, like the boil experiment, we didn't pick up cooked flavors from the boiling the honey. You know, there was some change to how it clarified and everything, but, you know, so in this case, it didn't really change much. Now, like Zat just said, the boiling point of ethanol is 171, and I tried 185, and that didn't work out so well. My theory was it was a crown cap. There's not that much alcohol. You won't build up that much head pressure. I was wrong.
plus the metal on the crown cap is pretty thin, I'm assuming, and then in the you know, the rubber might not, you know, might be more flexible at a higher temperature. There's probably some physics involved, you know, beyond just the pressure of the fluid in there as well.
Yeah, but low temperature, 165 for 5 minutes, should be enough to kill yeast. That's a standard temperature if you consult the FDA's website. Most food manufacturers go very high for a very short period of time because it's cheaper in the long run. You know, but you don't have to go that high for that. You know, for a short period of time, you can go a lower temperature, more gentle, mm-hmm. for a longer period of time and get the same effect. The next thing I want to do is try to take a mead that's already carbonated but still sweet and see if I can stop it from going mm-hmm. further with pasteurization. But I'm going to wait till I can have a deck. Because right now I've got an apartment and, you know, with no deck where I can do this, because I want to be able to set the pot outside with a sous vide machine. So if something goes really, really wrong, I'm not mopping the ceiling, because there's two kinds of home brewers: those that have mopped a ceiling and those that will. I've already mopped a ceiling. I don't want to do it again.
So is this an experiment where you set out to explore one question and found the answer to another?
Yeah, I really wanted to figure out whether or not pasteurization would actually work on the homebrew scale, because some commercial brewers do it. I kind of talked to Michael Fairbrother a year or two ago about it. And, you know, he does not pasteurize, and at the time he said he didn't think it was a good idea. But, you know, I think he told me they filter everything. But I do know some people, you know, big brewers, you know, do pasteurize. And I thought, well, everybody's always said that's heating this up, the finished product up, is bad because it changes the flavor. It makes everything taste cooked and taste caramelized. Nobody picked that up. 50 people, nobody said caramelized, cooked. Nobody picked up a flavor change in the ginger between the uncooked and the cooked variety. And remember, I said 165 for 5 minutes once it gets there. It took a good 45 minutes to get up to that point. And a good, you know, 45 minutes to, you know, cool down, because I let them cool in the water, mm-hmm. because, you know, at that point, these bottles were very hot, and I was concerned that if I pulled them out of the water and set them on a counter, thermal shock would make these bottles shatter. Yeah. And I don't like cleaning in general. I mean, I'm a brewer, but I'm not going to make work for myself. And I knew setting them down in a stainless steel sink, they would shatter mm-hmm. from thermal shock, so I let them cool in the water. So they were at that temperature at over 100 degrees for over an hour and a half, which is a pretty significant span of time. And it didn't affect the flavor at all.
What do you think, Steve? Are there practical applications you as a mead maker can think to use with this technique?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, if pasteurizing in the bottle is a viable technique to, say, not have to use sorbate, if you don't want to chemically stabilize the mead, that might be an alternative. It makes pretty good sense to me to do that. I'm actually more interested in your follow-up of having a bottle of, in this case, mead that's already carbonated. So the pressure's already in there. It's not going to make more pressure, I don't think. So you get this carbonated beverage that you pasteurize in the bottle. That would be very interesting because, like you say, there might be a way. You know, I always tell people you can't. You can either carbonate or you can back sweeten, but you can't do both. Now, maybe there's a point, if you're skillful, where you could allow it to carbonate for a few days, and then you could essentially kill it, but you've already captured the carbonation and the residual sugar. That would be very interesting to see if you could do that. So I think it's a real interesting thing to do. And both meads tasted fine. I do find, personally, that session meads, lower gravity meads, I think taste much better if they're carbonated, whether they're spritzy because they just didn't get stabilized and so they're a little spritzy, or you did it on purpose and primed them and carbonated. I always think, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8% meads, almost always better carbonated. Once you get up in the 10, 11, 12% range, I think they're better still. That's just my personal opinion, because they're going to drink more like a wine.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going with this, is can we have a sweet, sparkling mead? Because that's what everybody asks for that. Every time I talk to people about mead, they, well, I want something that tastes like, you know, strawberry champagne, you know, that that rot gut stuff, you know, that, you know, every you know, 14-year-old boy is trying to buy at the liquor store to give to his girlfriend. You know, you know the stuff I'm talking about. And that's illegal. Don't do that. Yeah. But, you know, that's what people are wanting. And so I was trying to – first I was trying to see if it was even possible to do that. I do think – so carbon dioxide is more soluble in cold solutions than warm solutions, which is why you force carbonate in the fridge, or you let it sit for a long time. So – my concern about, you know, following up on this is, are you going to build up too much pressure? I would aim for, you know, 2 atmospheres of pressure at most. You know, I wouldn't try to go like Berliner Weiss pressure and then stabilize it, because that'll just come out too much. And I would definitely recommend, if you do this for any reason, do not do it in corks. Use beer bottles that are, you know, crown capped, good and firm. Because I think this would shoot cork straight up, because all of these bottles had condensation around the ring after it was done and cooled.
I wondered if you could do it with a Grosch style bottle, with a you know, a flip top bottle.
Yeah, with the wire.
Mm-hmm. So they're even more sturdy than a crown cap, and the glass is a lot heavier. The bottles themselves are a lot heavier. So I mean, I'm kind of talking in my hat because I don't know what they're built for in terms of pressure and all that. But I bet you that'd be a good choice. I'm just thinking myself, oh, this is real interesting.
And you might want to wear safety glasses and do gloves. And I mean, because shattering glass is no fun. And legal disclaimer, don't do this at all. Don't do anything we're telling you to do. But no. But if you do, get back to us and let us know.
Well, I do wear safety goggles when I'm doing this sort of thing, for just that reason. But I think if you use a heavier bottle, this is not something you want to do with a very light bottle. Actually, when I'm going through my bottles, when I'm getting ready to bottle, I actually pick them all up. And you can tell by weight, because I've been doing this long enough, which ones are the thicker bottles. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones I set aside. And I did some of these in wine size, you know, champagne bottles that were got for that exact purpose, because that's a heavier bottle. So I think if you really want to, if you're going to try to do a sweet carbonation one, you need to be sure you use a Grosch bottle, which is good and heavy. And I think the thing about the bale and cap is that will actually release pressure if it gets to be too much.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
But a champagne bottle, because champagne bottles are designed to hold heavy, you know, heavy weight, heavy, you know, pressure. But don't do this with thin bottles. Don't do it with corks. Be careful. Be safe. Just think about what you're doing. You know, bottle bombs are no fun when you hear them go off in the other room. If you're standing there in your kitchen and it goes off, you know, that's a real problem. But, you know, sous vides are wonderful machines. But, you know, I know the all-electric systems that your friends down at High Gravity sell can be used for sous vide. I imagine you could use them the same way. All you're doing is circulating water. Yep. If you've got a rim system to heat your mash water, you can do the same thing. You know, you can throw an egg in there at 165 degrees, and it just turns wonderful after an hour. So
I did sous vide barbecue.
Yeah.
I did the barbecue like a week early, and then I vacuum sealed the ribs and the brisket and everything, and then we put it in the water in the morning and then went on about our day and then came back and opened it up, and all we had to do was crisp it just a little bit. It was great.
Yeah, that was
a good day. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, there's a couple. One is you could attempt to go up to 180 if you really wanted to and try to leave the bottle open and then seal it after you're done. It would take a different setup than probably how you did it, but you're pasteurizing, so you don't have to worry about anything. You can't do it and ferment at the same time, obviously. However, if you're worried about too much pressure building up, you could also, and in fact, you probably did this, is you can actually get pasteurization, I was checking the numbers, as low as 135 for the right period of time. So you could go lower if you're worried about that, although I'm not sure what the CO2 release would be on a longer period of time. But effectively, you actually pasteurize not just because you brought it to 165, but because you left it in the bath. Because brewers actually do 20 seconds at 165 to pasteurize. Now, that probably requires a lot more equipment and probably a vise at either end. The other thing is you can look at canning, because you could put a vise on it. You could put a clamp on a can and throw it in the sous vide and then take it out. You're not worried about shattering, and all you need is a claw.
Or a PET. I don't know what the temperature ramifications for PET is, but PET, a plastic as well.
Depending on PET, if PET is the HDPE, like brewing the boiling in a bucket, you're fine. If it's PE, you're not. I know.
So talking to that, I chose 165 for 5 minutes specifically because it was the most abuse I thought I could throw at this to get the highest effect of anything. Like I said, the FDA has a website that talks about pasteurization's time and temperature and everything. So I deliberately overdid this to try to provoke an effect and did not do it.
There you go. Now, do we have something else fun to taste? We do. Now, I'm gonna pause here for just a second, and then we'll get back to the fun stuff. Okay, now we have the bonus mead poured. What do we got?
I call this Partial Eclipse. So this is Orange Blossom Hydromel. Last year at Total Eclipse time, I went down to Central Oregon and stopped at Glory Bee Honey Company, and they had buckets of Orange Blossom honey on sale. Mm-hmm. So I bought enough to make this, which I call Partial Eclipse because it's a hydromel. In order to grow up the yeast cake to make its big brother, which I will share with these guys at another time. I didn't bring it this time. Sorry, folks. I call Total Eclipse. And this one, we started at 1067 and it ended at 1014. So it's very light, not a lot of alcohol, but it's orange blossom honey, which is practically cheating. Because it just is what it is. So,
but the recipe, very, very simple, I'm assuming? Or?
Yeah, this is about 9 pounds of orange blossom honey. So let me correct this. So I've gone to metric for all of my brewing. I have a degree in the sciences and it's been bugging me for 20 years. So I do everything in bricks and liters. So this worked out to about, I think this was 7 kilograms of honey in a 20-liter batch. That I'll double check that number and let you know by email because that could be drastically wrong. but it's a hydromel. And what I like about metric is you take a, if you have a high sugar Brix refractometer, you can see what the Brix of the honey is and say, okay, well, if it's 86.6 Brix of honey, you know it's 86.6% sugar. So, 1 kilogram in that case gets you 866 grams of fermentable sugar, and then you can do your math very easily. So once you convert, I'm sure all of our friends in Australia and Canada and everywhere will agree metric is better. But you just gotta bite the bullet and do it.
What do you think, Steve?
It's very tasty. It's a very nice mead. Very nice and light and orangey. The orange blossom honey really comes through. That's an easy drinker. I like it.
Yeah. Norm?
It's delicious. I like all Tim's meads. So,
so I'm curious, though, I'm sorry. So tell us about the yeast, nutrient additions, if any. Go.
All right. So I'm a firm believer in why yeast. Oh.
For those who aren't mead judges, hydromel is a light version of a mead. So if you're wondering what makes a difference is actually just the gravity and the strength of it is much lighter.
Thank you.
So I'm a big believer in degassing and staggered nutrient addition. So this was my normal dose of nutrients is a total of 3 teaspoons over about 5 days. 1 teaspoon up front, then half a teaspoon every other day until it's used. Degassing beforehand, because if you put light fine grain powder into a fermenting beverage, it's Mentos and Diet Coke, and there's no more panic in the world than trying to put your hand over the top of a carboy that is shooting a column of mead.
You're just redirecting at that point.
Actually, if that ever happens to you, the worst thing you could do is put your hand over the top because you spread the blast zone much further.
It depends on your ceiling issues. If you haven't cleaned a ceiling yet, you still are in safe mode.
Reminds me of the time I threw up in the back of my dad's friend's pickup truck or Bronco, but when I was a kid. But putting your hand over your mouth does not help the situation.
Does not help at all. Yeah. So what I do is I because it's a hydromel, I back off a teaspoon. If it's a sack, I increase a teaspoon in order to do things. But like I said, I made this mead because I wanted a hydromel, but I was growing up a batch of sweet mead yeast, which is my preferred yeast, so that I could do a sack orange blossom trad with the same honey. Because like I said, there's partial eclipse and total eclipse. And so I wanted a good, healthy yeast cake in order to attack a very large amount of orange blossom honey. And it didn't work as well because it's that particular mead finished very high still. But... Actually, Zot had that at the mead, the big brother of this, the mead exam, as one of my test meads. The proctors did not like it. Gordon Strong did not like it at all.
Yeah, these I wouldn't have known that they were related. And partly, they're relatively new. How long does it take to ferment end-to-end?
So this started on February 11th and ended on March 25th. Mm. So just that quick. Start to finish.
How about the big brother?
The big brother took longer because, the bigger the mead is, the longer it takes. So my rule of thumb is 2 months end-to-end for standard mead. Hydromels will go about 6 weeks. Sacks will go about, 10 weeks. Basically you drop or add a week. This particular thing took longer. I had to nurse it a little more. But again, there was so much honey there, there was never going to get through all of it. But the nice thing is, this is a tip if you want to make, a high-gravity beer or high-gravity meat or something, brew something small as a starter. Because that yeast is good and healthy and everything, but you've got to, when that stops, you've got to rack and add more. Because the big brother took off right away, once it got going. But that was the technique, this was a starter for something much larger.
How often are you degassing? Once a day?
I degas every day for 2 minutes because I don't put my drill up to full speed because it foams over. And by the way, I keep my carboys I have a big mouth fermenter. I keep them in a bus tub because I've had enough overflows. And I said earlier, I don't like cleaning. Why make more work if you don't have to? So, That's what I do is I degas every day, and then I add nutrient after I've completed the degassing, and then I give it another minute with a wine whip to make sure that nutrient is well distributed, because you want to make sure it's well thing. But here's the secret is I use 2 parts DAP, 1 part Fermade K, and like I said, a maximum of about 3 teaspoons. If you go to a lot of homebrew shops, and you don't have a Steve in your town who knows what he's doing, and will help you, pick up a pack of nutrients, it's 8 ounces, and it says, add this to your mead. So you do, and the judges go, that tastes like a Flintstone chewable vitamin. Yeah. Because it does. So the secret is you use small amounts. You use just enough for the yeast to go and maintain a healthy curve. And then they don't throw out any off flavors, because even the Big Brother, like I said, people didn't, some of the judges didn't like it. There were no off flavors in there. It was just, there was a lot of raw honey flavor left in it because it hadn't fermented and it hasn't aged.
So what's, I'm just curious about the Big Brother. What's the ABV of the Big Brother?
About 16%, and this is about 8.
Right. So the Big Brother, then one would expect that if you leave it in the bottle, say for a year, I mean, that's a big mead, 2 years, that raw flavor will eventually settle out. Or do you think, or not? I'm curious.
It should. It should mellow out, and that raw flavor should go away for a year. And that was the plan, is to age it for a long time and let it sit. Because I got a deal on Orange Blossom Honey, but it's not cheap unless you happen to live in Southern California or, I guess, Texas, because all the Florida orange groves are going away from citrus greening. But you got to live where it is in order to get it. I get Blackberry Blossom Honey cheap. But Orange Blossom Honey is not something we generally get. So you got to treat it nice.
Very nice. Well, guys, this has been fun. I think maybe dinner and more beer at another event. Maybe.
In order. It's a kickoff party, or it used to be pro night.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks everybody. Thanks, Tim, for the wonderful meads and the fun experiment, and thanks everybody else.
Yay!
Well, thanks again to Tim, Steve, Bob, Norm, and Zot. Tim always has great mead to share, and I know that the gears are turning out there in the minds of homebrewers who already have plans to use this technique in one way or another. If you do use it, please drop me a line and let me know how it comes out, and I'll share your note with Tim and with the listeners, too. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing, Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering, and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can find their logbooks. You can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at basicbrewingshop.com. Also, take a look at our tie-dye silicone pints. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website, brought by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.